Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you, this is your first time, we welcome you as well. Today, we have Dr. Nancy Bailey. She is known near and far. She is loved, respected by almost everyone that you talk to. And we're going to have her today because of her work and all the things that she has been doing and that those things that make her so near and dear to everyone. Dr. Bailey is a former special education teacher and principal. She has a PhD in educational administration from Florida State University. She has many awards and grants in the field of education. And so, Nancy, welcome to the War Report.
Hi, James. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
And, it's our pleasure, to say the least. And I was not exaggerating when I said you are loved by everyone near and far.
Thank you. Just give
you an example, I had many people send me PMs saying, I love Nancy. I can't wait to hear her. I love Nancy. It got really, really disturbing to me when my own team kept saying, oh, we love Nancy, we love Nancy. I'm like, you don't say that about me. You don't say that about me.
Why they just say the opposite.
They love you.
Well, that's great. I really appreciate being on the show, and I look forward to talking with you about these issues. I'm a little of an introvert, so this is quite a challenge for me, but I look forward to talking with you about these important issues, and thank you for bringing up my book. I appreciate that as well. And I guess we should start about talking about early childhood, one of my favorite topics.
Okay. Let me say this. Your book, Misguided Education Reform, is organized almost identical to the way in which I try and organize the shows on the War Report. I look for the most critical, salient issues in the war and then try and invite best person or persons to talk about or have a conversation over those issues. That's exactly what you do in your book. And for those who don't have the book, she has seven areas that she identifies as salient in the war. And within those seven areas, she identifies 69 issues in total. Magnificent. So let's start with the first issue that you felt was one of the more salient issues in this war.
Well, I'm very concerned, as many are, about early childhood education, I think, because that's the point where children start former schooling, and right now the skills that are being pushed down are much more difficult than they ever have been. I think that whether it's preschool, kindergarten, first, second, or third grade, children are being expected to do much more than ever before. And I'm concerned about what the future will be if they continue to have so much pressure, and that pressure comes in the way of removing the important play that children have in order to develop or to remove recess. Many of the things that are being taken away from early childhood education are really critical to early childhood development and go against the research that we've accumulated throughout the years. When we look at Piaget, Montessori, Erickson, and Vygotsky, all of the great researchers that we've had that have outlined the necessity of play and all these important variables for young children. So it's quite alarming, I think, and I've noticed on my blog whenever I've written anything about early childhood education, it usually is a post that does quite well because people are very, very concerned, like I am, about this area. And when you think about the fact that the term kindergarten is translated into the children's garden, and when you think of kindergarten now and the way young children are being given tests, many, many tests, some written tests, and it's just totally inappropriate, and many people know this and are concerned about it. So I think in terms also of play and the importance of play, quite often people who are interested in corporatizing schools will scoff at the idea of play. You often see that in articles where they say play isn't as important as we make it, and they don't seem to have the realization that children are actually learning. Play isn't a waste of time. Children are actively learning. Several years ago, I was quite fortunate to attend the Save Our Schools meeting in Washington, D.C. It was the year after they had the big rally, but it was no less important. They had some tremendous speakers. And I sat in on a small workshop with Deborah Meyer and Nancy Carlson Page, two really great experts in this area. And Nancy Carlson Page told a story that really resonated with me, and it was about a grandchild who had been given a tricycle. And the adults in the room just stood back and let that child figure out how to get on the tricycle, how to hold the handlebars, how to pedal it. They let it up to the child. They let that whole experience be up to the child. And to me, that makes so much sense because the child's problem solving. And it goes to show you that when children figure things out on their own, it's truly helping them to problem solve. It's helping them to figure things out. It isn't just a waste of time. And when you take away these periods of time where children are able to socialize with one another and do all of this active play, whether it be dressing up or playing in little kitchen sets or building blocks and all the wonderful things that come with play, children are learning tremendous skills in those activities. The loss of recess has been taking place
Nancy,
many years ago.
Yes. Why do you think this has happened?
Well,
the
I think
loss
it comes
of
about
kindergarten.
Well, I think it comes about because of the idea of privatization and the point that people want to kind of get rid of what we have in the way of schooling now. Or they're just misguided, and that's why I used that word in the title of my book. I think there are a lot of people now who have, and they may be well-meaning, but they think that we need to put more pressure on our kids. There's this idea that they have a connection that young children, you always hear the excuse that, well, preschool, if we don't have strong preschools, we won't have a strong economy. And there just absolutely is not really any connection. What we do know is that children who are very young need to have nurturing experiences. If they come from poverty, they don't get those nurturing experiences. They aren't exposed to you know, beautiful picture books. They aren't exposed to good, to a lot of play that is nurturing kind of play. They miss out on the experiences that children who are, come from wealthier families have. We know this, but instead of giving children those more nurturing experiences, there's this idea that we somehow need to put more pressure on them to learn faster and harder. And so it's just a terrible mistake that people who...
Yeah, but Nancy, you do say in your book that this is a terrible, misguided education reform. Mm-hmm. I wrote, is it a misguided education reform? I said, no. I say that it's the corporate state Machiavellian agenda to privatize public education,
mm-hmm.
which means it's a deliberate plan, well-executed strategy, as opposed to being just misguided in terms of, well, they maybe had good intentions or they were misinformed and they developed a plan on faulty data. It's not intended and et cetera. I say no to that. I say that it was intended because the whole idea is to privatize education, public education from pre-K to PhD.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my answer to this question of whether or not it's misguided and why they are doing the things that they're doing to eliminate kindergarten as we have known it in favor of this early push for education skills for future employment, starting with three-year-olds, four-year-olds. Totally insane, my opinion.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you on that point. And certainly, I think I probably try very hard in my own mind to see something good in the people who are doing the reforms. I like to think that they are somehow just terribly mistaken in what they're doing. But I certainly do understand what you're saying and do see where that's happening, and I struggle in my own thinking with that. I guess I'd like to try to see the good in people. For example, I'll use an example. When Benjamin O'Canada started denying kids recess in Atlanta, you know, that to me was just awful. I just thought it was the most terrible thing I ever heard of. It was so ridiculous that you wouldn't give children breaks. And I thought he was just the worst person in the world. And then I read a few months later that he had left Atlanta and gone, I'm not sure if it was Seattle or Portland, but somewhere in the Northwest. And while he still didn't want recess, he was quite an advocate for children having art in the schools. And of course, I also have a chapter about getting rid of the arts in the schools. So, you know, I understand what you're saying, and I certainly do believe there's an element of that. And I, you know, it's hard for me to say that a lot of the people, the Gates Foundation, the Broad Foundation, the Waltons, it's really hard for me to say that they are really having good intentions when there is so much out there that I think that they ignore that is contrary to what they're trying to do. So I do understand what you're saying. I guess there's something about me trying to find something good in these people, and it just seems so bizarre what they're doing in the form of privatization. But it is.
Nancy, I have an answer for you. That's why people love you, because you've tried to find the good and.
Well, you know,
that's probably why they don't say they love me, because I don't.
Well, believe me, when you're not around, I have a lot of cuss words for a lot of the stuff going on, and I do not like certainly many of the terrible things happening to our kids. and would not continue writing. And I think I do go after people. I've written some things that are pretty negative about Bill Gates and Arne Duncan, certainly. But, you know, it's just... But the whole point is that that early childhood is really warped right now, and we do need to be very concerned about all of these things. Everybody is, I think, or I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but we do need good preschool. We do need good kindergarten. We do need to look for children. For example, my area of special ed, I'm just shocked that response to intervention, they go in and try to test everybody. Like they're looking for everybody to have disabilities right away. That this is a very controversial thing right away, right now too. And they're really saying that the discrepancy model of finding a disability and learning that children have a high IQ but they don't test well achievement-wise means that there's some kind of mild disability going on there. I think that the discrepancy model worked pretty well. You know, I don't think trying to find a disability in everybody and putting kids through all this testing at an early age is really helpful to children. So, you know, I tend to look at the different issues that are going on, and I really hate some of the stuff that's happening. And I think we need to focus on those issues and try to change them and try to improve them for children and make them, just work out better. We need to find, if we're going to identify learning disabilities early on, we need to look and observe. But I don't think we need all that kind of testing that we give the kids. I think a lot of that is just very confusing and designed to keep kids actually out of getting the kind of services they need. And I think you and I would agree. I think everybody...
That brings me to the next question from your book, and that is, in Chapter 2, you talk about the trouble with testing and Common Core state standards. You sort of like have touched on it already. Can you amplify what you said in that chapter?
Well, for one thing, standardized testing has really been a problem, even before Common Core, pretty much since No Child Left Behind, even maybe before we've relied on standardized testing. I come from special ed, so I am not against testing. I think that some testing is very valuable to a teacher. And I'd like to point out that I think I've been reading yesterday, the Washington Post came out with an article about the many civil rights groups that are now really being very critical of the opt-out movement because, and they call them anti-tests. They continually call the opt-out movement anti-tests, and I don't think that's true. And I noticed that one of the opt-out moms who fights for good, actually having kids not just opt out, but good testing, you know, they're not against testing. They're against the bad kind of testing that's taking place right now. And so much testing, all kids do is test nowadays. And so I really hate to see these other groups get away with calling opting out folks anti-testing, because I don't think that's what they are. I think there might be some who are against, you know, testing altogether. But for the most part, most of the parents that are now keeping their kids from taking these tests are not anti-testing. They just recognize that the tests that are being done today are not good tests. And that leads me to Common Core and PARC and Smarter Balance. I get so tired of hearing, Jane, people in the media constantly say that Common Core will make college career-ready students. Common Core will be successful. They always speak affirmatively. And Bill Gates himself, who is really behind Common Core state standards, Bill Gates and all the governors, Bill Gates himself came out and said it would take 10 years before anyone would know whether this worked. So I think that this idea that Common Core is the be-all and end-all for education is really quite frightening. And it's also used in a strange way. People don't always talk about it this way, but Common Core is used a lot to pretty much ridicule teachers. And by doing that, they have this way of saying, well, teachers don't know how to roll it out. They don't know how to do the Common Core yet. They're going to have to take all this in service to learn how to do it. And that's really troubling to me as well. And I think that fits into the privatization push that we have going on in this country. Common Core, if you look at it closely, is really nothing new. You know, when they talk about, for example, text complexity, and by the way, they always put adjectives in front of what they're doing, which makes it sound like it's something very, very involved, like deeper learning. You know, what is deeper learning? I'm always amazed at some of the vocabulary they use with Common Core. But anyway, when they talk about text complexity, we've had Fry readability scales for years to figure out how difficult a text is before we get a kid to read. Usually teachers, when they're teaching reading, don't even need that. They can kind of sum up by reading with a child where they're at. And they also look at a basic test score and see what level they're working at. So some of this stuff, it's almost like these Common Core people, who never were teachers, like David Coleman and some of the others, it's almost like they went to a college library and pulled out some old teacher books and repackaged it to make it their own and put it out there. But I don't see Common Core as being anything that new. What's new is that they're kind of corralling certain standards and then pushing a lot of them down to earlier levels where they will be much more difficult for a lot of children to pass, and making it look like these standards are appropriate for everybody, including kids with disabilities. And then they don't leave these children with any kind of safety net if they don't master the standards. They have all these kind of wild approaches, the universal approach to learning and universal design. And a lot of it, I think, is really leading children to technology. You know, they talk a lot about assistive learning. And I think, really, the whole privatization movement right now, in my opinion, is really geared towards pushing kids to be more online, to get away from schools, to get away from having teachers, to set up more rocket ship-style charter schools where children will be primarily learning online. And so where testing goes, I think it's primarily to privatize schools. They don't want kids to do really well on those tests. And when they don't do well, schools shut down, teachers lose their jobs, and testing is very, very draconian. And it is also very harmful to children. So you have standardized testing that started early on. You were already, you know, schools were already starting to be very punitive with the testing. And then Common Core now is just another way to implement more difficult testing. I think everybody's seeing that with the PARC and Smarter Balance. They're not tests that really lift children and help teachers teach better. They're going to be more a way to show that children aren't reaching the kinds of goals they want and to be able to eventually shut down public schools. So
you make very similar points in the next issue that I wanted you to talk on, and that is special education, the abandonment of a commitment to special ed. But also in that chapter, you talk about privatization, you talk about harm. Let's segue to there, because you pretty much have led us to the next issue. So let's focus on special ed.
Well, special education right now is really, I think, under attack. And what's happened when, you know, I'm old enough to remember when we really started to focus on special ed and get the kids out of the institutions, which were horrible, and start giving them the services. And when I was in my undergraduate program, they had actually broken special education into different specialty areas. For example, I got my undergraduate degree. At the time, it was called Teaching Emotionally Disturbed Kids. And so I took a lot of psychology. I studied different kinds of behavioral problems. There were many pioneers in special ed at that time who were coming out with different ways of setting up your classroom, looking at what caused children to react good and bad within the class setting, and to try to help them to improve on their behavior and to be able to do better in the regular classroom. And then I actually did student teaching at Hawthorne Center, which was a residential center outside of Detroit, which had a lot of people from various schools. I was up in Michigan, where you went to Wayne State, right? So,
yes.
But Hawthorne Center worked very with a lot of kids who had very serious problems, and there were a lot of special ed pioneers who were working there from the University of Michigan and some of the other schools in Michigan. It was really a sort of a training ground for teachers and social workers and everybody to come together to study kids who have emotional problems. Now, when you jump forward, IDEA really changed a lot of that. Now you don't really see any classes for kids with emotional problems. What's happened is with IDEA, most of the kids were funneled into the regular classroom. And when I start talking about this, I have to be really careful, because parents, many, many parents, want to see inclusion happen. They want their kids to be in the regular classroom. And one of the jobs that I had for many years was teaching in a resource class, where I worked very hard to get kids mainstreamed into regular classes for all of their classes except...
Nancy, let me stop you for a second.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Explain inclusion. I just got a PM from a parent who says basically that she agrees with everything that you're saying about special education, but she also sees it as a way for teachers to put kids out of her class who are floundering with the mm-hmm. Common Core and put them into inclusion classes where they can get additional support.
Okay, well,
inclusion
means that all kids with special needs are placed into a regular class, and they're to get the any kind of support they get. When we first started having inclusion, kids with special needs were supposed to get additional support from a special ed teacher in the regular class. And, inclusion is one step. We used to talk about mainstreaming, because certain kids would get some help outside of that regular class, but, they go to, and with inclusion, you're in a regular class all the time. And so you have a lot of kids now with special needs who are in regular classes. And in IDEA was really pushing the least restrictive environment, which meant that students would be primarily in the regular class. Now, the problem with that is we really still need a continuum of services with special ed. There are some children that could do very well in inclusion or in a regular class with some support from the resource class, or there are some students that still might do well in the self-contained class. And self-contained classes have really taken a beating in the last few years, because people have seen those classes as not really contributing much. But then again, other parents have been pleased with those classes because they've worked more on life skills. So everybody wants their child to do the best they possibly can. They worry about their child's future, and they want their child to succeed. Working in the regular class is at the top of the line, where you should be able to accomplish and master sometimes with accommodation, the test, the Common Core test that you get or whatever test you get in that regular class. The problem with that is that a lot of kids with special needs need more support. And we shouldn't make that support look like there's something wrong with it. Now, I don't care if you change the name special ed to something else. Don't even use that term if you have to, but at least give kids a resource class where they can go when they're struggling with reading, or give them, if they need a self-contained class, give them that if that's a decision made based on a parent, a school psychologist, a special ed teacher, a social worker, assistant principals. That's the IEP plan. That's the way we used to do it in the past. That idea changed all that, and in some schools, you don't even have a resource class anymore. Kids are just plopped into that regular class, and if they're lucky, they might get some support. But special ed is really under attack. When you hear Arne Duncan say he wants all kids who have special needs to master the same tests as everybody else, you have to really ask, you know, how are they going to do that? And what happens if they don't do that? Now, a lot of the civil rights groups and like the National Learning Disabilities Association, a lot of these groups are really promoting inclusion. Parents want their kids in the regular class because they see that as a gateway to college. They see that as a gateway to careers. And I'm saying that they still should be open to permitting their kids to get some special help. Now, when you talk about privatization, special ed has never, ever been funded the way it was supposed to be funded. Special ed, when they first wrote Public Law 94-142 in the early 70s, there was not even any kind of Rose Garden ceremony. President Ford knew that they were going to have trouble funding this. He knew that it was going to run into trouble. And, you know, he had terrific foresight because it is in trouble now. People do not want to fund special ed. Or if they do fund it, they want it to be privatized funding. So am I answering the question right? I can easily ramble here, especially when I'm nervous.
Yes, you did. And you also opened the door for my next question, and that is the movement to criminalize student behavior in the classroom, in the school, which shuttles kids off to the school-to-prison pipeline. You speak about the danger of criminalizing students.
Well, certainly.
Do you see a tie-in with what you just said in terms of, you know, the teacher wants to be able to make the progress that's demanded of her in terms of preparing students for being successful? Well, I don't even know you could ever be successful on a Common Core test.
Well, there are a number of problems, I think, happening as far as discipline in our schools. The zero tolerance idea has unnecessarily punished a lot of kids who get into some trouble and never have a chance to explain their situation. If a child gets in trouble in school, it's even worse than if they get in trouble outside of school, because the rules are much more difficult. They don't have access to a lawyer, really. They're just they just get in serious trouble. And I think that when you consider special education, when you've removed from the school, say, a class that could work with children who have behavioral problems or emotional problems, when you remove these special ed classes, then kids have nowhere to go. They're in the regular class. They get in trouble there, and then they wind up, you know, being in more serious trouble with records. And what people don't realize is that when a child gets a record, any kind of juvenile record, it really sticks with them. It's really hard to get rid of it. And there are some lawyers now that actually include that in their practice, trying to help with that, because poor kids don't have access to that. And so you can see poor children getting into problems where they just continue to go downhill. So there really needs to be I think a better support system, a better mental health support system for children in our public schools. And certainly, when you see a child with some problems going on in school, we need to somehow be able to, and school is a great, school is a great place to identify kids who are having problems and then get them the help they need. It's just that when teachers have huge class sizes and kids of a variety of disabilities in their class, not to mention kids who may have a second language that they need to address, and then you have large class sizes, then you might let certain children slip through the cracks, or you might inadvertently continue to get a child in trouble in class because you don't know what to do with them. I mean, when you have so many kids in your class and you have one child disrupting your class, you're going to try to get them out of there. Or your time, if you don't do that, your time will be spent trying to get them to settle down or to do the right kinds of things in the class so they won't be disrupting others. But it takes a toll on everybody, and usually teachers send those kids out and they continuously get in trouble. And we really need, I think, a better way of identifying children who have difficulties, these emotional and behavioral difficulties. And then I think often that special ed should be a more transient, it should be something where children can flow easily from one class to another. One of the concerns with special ed in the past, which I do agree with, is that sometimes children would sit in a self-contained class, say, and they weren't communicating with other kids in the school, and they didn't ever move out of that class, or they didn't move up. They were just sort of stuck there. And I think sometimes kids can move from one class to the other, and there should be a better, more flexible way of moving kids around and just looking at their disabilities and giving them and their parents the support that they need. It shouldn't be considered something terrible if your child needs to go 1 or 2 hours a day to a resource class to get some help, especially if when they get that help, they can go back into the class and succeed, go back into the regular class and succeed. You know, I used to have a student in my resource class that didn't even see me during the week. They would just check in with me at the end of the week and let me know whether they were doing all right. And I think in many ways we were on track and doing things quite well for many years. But I think right now the optimal goal for the people who want to privatize schools is to shut down special education. And what I think we will see now are more and more charter schools that are being opened up for kids who aren't succeeding in the regular class, which is, to me, extremely ironic, since many of the parents in these regular classes did not want their child to be separated from the regular, from the other students. So to privatize right now, I think, you know, these kids aren't being accepted into the charters, and what we'll see, I think, in the future are more charter schools for special ed kids.
Okay. So, what about when is this one of your personal best issues, and that is the elimination of arts and humanities in the curriculum at high school?
Yes. Well, yes, and I think also being interested in kids who have disabilities, sometimes the arts are where they thrive. And so when a school removes the arts, and many, especially poor schools, which I think it has just angers many people. I know one of my, a person who I admire very much is Angie Villa from Pennsylvania, who's an art teacher, and she really speaks up for the need, not just of art classes in schools, but art classes that are covered by teachers who are credentialed in art. And kids who have disabilities, they may not read well, they may not write well, they may not do math, but they may be very, very good at doing the arts. And we should give them those opportunities. But if you cut the arts in school and you just constantly say they must do well in reading and math and never give them the opportunity to do well in the arts, then that will be it. So cutting the arts to me has been a very serious result of this effort to privatize schools. And I can only hope that that changes in the future. I, you know, the president started, they chose this arts project that they did with about eight schools in the country, and they just are flooding those schools with the arts. And it's so strange to me that the reason they're doing this is because they say they want to see if the arts will keep kids in school and if the arts will help children do well on tests. Well, we know that the arts will do those things, but more importantly, we should be giving kids the arts because the arts are just good for the arts' sake. And the fact is, there are many jobs out there that involve the arts. And so the arts are, to me, very important and a terrible loss right now for so many schools. Music, art.
You know what, Nancy?
Mm-hmm.
There's a theme that has showed itself at the end of every one of your major points, and that is the privatization of public education, which is what this show is all about.
Right.
And you keep saying it, which means it's the underlining, again, my belief, the underlining driving force behind every issue, the 49 issues that you identify in your book and talk about so well, is related to the effort to privatize public education. I also put in front of that the destruction of private education for the purposes of being able to erect a national/global privatized public/education system. So you're amplifying that in almost everything that you say. And as our time begins to count down, I'll go to the next chapter, chapter 7, when you talk about public school problem buildings. Nowhere does this idea of privatization manifest itself more than it does in the last chapter of your book. And particularly when you quote Alex Molnar about whether or not the privatizers have good motives versus a profit motive.
Mm-hmm.
Explain to the public what he was talking about. You do it so well in very brief form in that chapter when you talk about the tax credit incentives that people get when they build and start charter schools.
Well, I do think we see that happening now, where I know that there are some places where you see charter schools, brand new charter schools that are being built, the for-profit kind, the chain charters that are going around the country. I was in California a while back, and out in the distance I saw a purple building. And I thought, where have I seen that before? Well, it was a rocket ship school, and rocket ship is one of many, you know, charters. But these charters are getting a lot of the funding that would typically go to buildings through these various tax programs. And so, you know, we have in this country schools, public schools, that have really had terrible problems with building renovations, and some of them are even quite dangerous. I live near Memphis. We have a lot of schools in Memphis that would really fall apart in the case of an earthquake. They're built with unreinforced masonry, and this is an issue that I got kind of involved in after Katrina. Everybody in Memphis was very worried about the schools here, and it didn't last long, and quite frankly, a lot of parents aren't concerned about this either, but we have a lot of schools, and we see it also in tornado territory, where we saw the terrible tornado a year or so ago, and lives were lost. And, you know, it's hard to fight, or it's hard to build schools that will stand up against nature, but we do have a lot of buildings that aren't really good for kids in our country, and we should really look at that more closely. It should be a real number one priority, I think. California has done some things because they really had some schools collapse in some of the earthquakes they've had out there, but in the past. But we've been very lucky because, interestingly enough, the earthquakes that we've had in this country, kids were out of school. In Alaska, when we had the earthquake there years ago, it was in the 60s. The kids were out of school for Good Friday, and in California, they had just been dismissed from school. So that's all a wonderful thing, but it doesn't drive home the fact that we do have some dangerous schools in this country. But even along with that, we have schools that kids sit and take tests, and the room might be too warm, so they don't do well on the test. We don't consider those kinds of variables when we get these test scores back, where we wind up shutting down schools. But so we've got all these buildings that aren't very good still in this country, and yet we're going to now funnel that money into brand-new charter schools and have a two-system kind of thing going on. And that is, I think, a real push for privatization. And what you'll see now, I think, are schools that look like the old schools that we had, only now they will be schools that are owned by for-profit companies instead of the public. And so that, I think, is pretty much where we're going right now. You do see a lot of places, I think, in West Palm, there have been some places that have really brought this up to their school boards to say, you know, why are we funding, you know, schools that have that will be for-profit schools that are coming in instead of our own public schools. So people are starting to become more aware of this, and hopefully they'll you know, be a little more, we'll push back more on it and try to get the repairs done to their own schools and the building of new schools that are actually truly public schools in the future. But, you know, certainly my book did have at its core the privatization of schools. But, you know, I think when it comes to privatization, there are many people who really believe that this is the way to go, that it will make a good school, that the free market is the way it will work. And I think they're just definitely wrong, and many of the things they're doing to schools will have the ultimate will result in shutting down schools and creating a total privatized system if we don't try to stop it and recognize it for what it is.
You know, you just made me think of something that I used to hear my mother and grandmother say. And that is, the road to hell is often paved with good intentions. I don't know if you've ever heard that expression.
Yes, I have heard that, yes.
And so what I'm thinking is that, okay, even if they had a modicum, and I'm not giving this to them, I just a modicum of good intentions, or what they call good intention, or assume good intention. You see, I'm having trouble saying that, ascribing something good to their intention. That even so, as Bill Gates said after the disastrous, was it $2 billion effort to reduce large high schools down to small high schools, clusters of small high schools, and disrupting the lives and everything that took place. After 10 years, he finally said, well, that was not a good idea like I originally thought. But this same guy said about Common Core and about testing, it'll take 10 years. He's always on this 10-year thing. It'll take 10 years before we really know what we're doing is the right thing. 10 years of screwing over people, young people, teachers, families, lives, livelihood, community, sense of community, preparation for life, participating in democracy, to find out maybe 10 years from now that, oops, that was another idea that really wasn't a good idea, especially when I first thought about it and put my billions into it.
Well, James, you'll get no argument from me. I mean, I certainly think that these people have a lot of arrogance. I don't think they do listen to the rest of us, and that is truly a concern. I was, where did I just hear Bill Gates? Well, I guess it was Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and some other man. I can't remember his name, but they were just on CNBC the other day.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
That was the, yes.
Yeah.
That was like less than a week ago on a morning talk show.
Right, and I was almost embarrassed for them because they were just talking like they really didn't have a clue. They were talking about how wonderful the charters were, how they're just making so many gains. They were talking about just all the things that they believe in such an affirmative way when there really is no proof, and there are so many questions as to what they were talking about. They just seem to be in sort of another world and didn't seem to understand, some of the real research. I don't think a lot of these people do research into what's really happening or what's really correct. You know, it's kind of like Jeb Bush and his push for retention. He just believes so thoroughly in that. But does he ever read the research? Does he ever try to understand the opposite side of that? And it's very scary, I think, that there are so many people who are now making...
Nancy, I'm going to have to cut you short on that. We got less than a minute. What is the number one takeaway you want the public to get from your book?
I think the number one takeaway is that there are a lot of different things happening in schools that are detrimental to children. I think that we need to look at all the areas that we talked about today and continue doing what we're doing. I think that there are marvelous parents and teachers out there who do have tremendous discussions on social media. I think we need to stick together. We need to, wherever we are in our communities, in our states. For example, I'm in Tennessee, and I'm so proud of the TEA. I just want to add that. They have pushed back so much. And as a union, they have pushed back on the Achievement School District, which is charters running amok. They have pushed back on the...
Okay, Nancy, our time is up. Our time is up. I know we probably could go on for another hour, but... And maybe we'll get you back on, and we'll talk about the rest of things in your book and the new things that are going on. But with that, folks, going to have to say good evening and hope everyone have a good Sunday. And thanks for listening.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.